Well, welcome to the podcast, Are You Taking Care of Yourself? I'm Dr. Michael Finkelstein, and I'm joined today again by Ian Newhem. This is the third of a series of three podcasts on the subject of diabetes, and Ian is not only the collaborator on my book, 77 Questions for Skillful Living, but he's also the co-author of another and a series of books called The 30-Day Diabetes Miracles, and or Miracle. And I'd like to go back to our conversation, Ian, with regard to the subject of foods and diet and fiber that we had in the last podcast. And we ended there with this issue, which I think is real relevant, which is that people have information. They have, for the most part, more access to the types of foods we talked about. They even have perhaps the motivation because they're aware of the downsides of not taking care of themselves, but yet I find that people are struggling taking care of themselves. And so it leads me to ask the question, and I'd like you to reflect on that. What's going on in the mind of somebody, perhaps with diabetes, or maybe it can be more generalized within any other condition, that prevents them from really executing these smarter, more skillful plans? That I think, is relevant in this conversation on the subject of diabetes.
I think that's a tough question. It's sort of a question in general for our culture, isn't it? That there is something in between stimulus and response, isn't there? It seems like there isn't. It seems like something happens in, something stimulates us and we immediately respond. It happens in on the highway when someone cuts us off and we immediately respond. It happens in politics. Something happens and we immediately respond. But there's a gap there in between. You know, I used to live in Manchester, England, and I lived in London as well, and there's a little sign above the underground there called Mind the Gap, and it's there to prevent us from falling onto the subway car. And it's a little apt metaphor for what happens inside our mind as well, that there's a gap between stimulus and response, and we choose what happens in the gap between stimulus and response. That's where, or rather when, in a fraction of a second, a millisecond, where we can consider or select or act rather than simply react to a stimulus. So it's really important. It was an important lesson for me, so I don't want to sound like I'm lecturing. I'm sort of talking to myself here as I'm talking to everyone else. If something happens, like, so if I see a bag of candy in a supermarket, or if I just think about it, it's my favorite candy. It's that one I've savored since I was a toddler. I have a second, a fraction of a second, to sort of think about what I'm going to do. I really feel like I deserve it. I feel like I might be a slave to it. I feel like it's in control of me. I feel like I might not have a choice. Or if somebody tells me, you know, Dr. Finkelstein would really say that an apple is a better choice than this candy. I don't even want to mention it because it's going to, because I'm a slave to it. But deep down, don't I know I do have a choice? Deep down, don't I know that there is something more important than this immediate gratification of my sweet tooth? You know, don't I know that I want to be here for my partner? Don't I know that I want to be here for my mother? Don't I know that I want to be here to win the Nobel Prize for Literature? Don't I know that there's something deeper than this immediate gratification of our culture? So in that second, if I just get over that little hump of that second, there's something deeper. And this, of course, extends to something far, far deeper. If I can get over that second, I know I'm taking care of myself, and I have conquered something, I've vanquished something, I've overpowered something, and succeeded in something much more powerful. And every time I get over that little hump, it's easier to do the next one.
Now, that's actually, you know, you said something that is remarkably insightful and I think practical at the same time, which is, you know, in your story in terms of the thought process of what goes on in your mind in that gap, was the question, you know, what do I care about this for? And that question has two aspects, or the answer has two aspects. One is yourself, but it was yourself in the context of your relationship to others or another, and that could mean something greater than even other human beings. There seems to me that the sort of the meaning and purpose of one's life has to be sort of captured in that moment in the gap. Otherwise, we could wind up being sort of nihilistic. If we're, what are we living for? If we don't have a good answer to that question, then you might as well soothe yourself with the candy.
That's right. And you know what? I do want to talk about purpose, but you just said something really profound to me that just made me think. You know what? It's okay to take the candy sometimes. You know what? Sometimes I do. In the end, if you take the candy, that's okay, as long as it's a real decision. As long as it's a choice and not something mindless. You know, what separates us from the animals, and it's not that there's something wrong with the animals, but what separates humans from other creatures is that we think, therefore we are. So as long as we're thinking and we're not acting mindlessly, there is a voice that echoes out of that gap. And something that you talked about in your book, something that you and I have talked about a lot, is that we should listen to that voice. If there is a hunger there, from whence is that hunger coming? So where is that hunger? Is it hunger from our stomach? Because that's very doubtful. We're not really hungry. And if we are, then an apple will satisfy it. Where is that sweetness coming from? What's missing? And, you know, just to, you know, maybe I'm being too vulnerable here on a podcast, but what am I really hungry for right now in this moment that I want that candy? Maybe it's something from my childhood, and that's scary and deep. So I need to stop, even if it's in the supermarket, and think about it. Do I want love right now, or do I want something from my mother? Or do I want something, do I really want that Nobel Prize because that's missing from my life? Or do I want my boss to treat me better? Or do I want to feel less fat right now or more desirable for my partner? What is it? Because it's probably not about Skittles. You know, if it really is Skittles and I want the taste of Skittles, then okay, I'll have a bag of Skittles. But then I'm making a decision, and it really is about the Skittles. The likelihood is it's not. You know, there's probably not a biologic need right now or a physiologic need for Skittles. That's really doubtful. It's probably a giant juggernaut of advertising and other things that is doing it. It's somebody's making a lot of money thinking about the color and the placement on the shelf exactly where I am. And then if I think about that in the 1 millisecond it takes before I reach, then I think, you know what, I'm not a slave to advertising. You know, and then I'm not a creature.
Well, so, you know, here lies the challenge for people, though, is that that's a split second where all that goes on.
Right.
So, and there's so much momentum behind the habits that we have gotten ourselves into that there isn't a lot, you know, a large window of opportunity for us to intervene this consciousness.
Right.
On a day-to-day, moment-to-moment level. So my suggestion as I'm listening then is this is just something that one needs to be addressed, meaning it needs to be identified as an important topic for each person. And then there has to become somewhat of a strategy on how to deal with the habit that will prevent you from sort of intervening this supertentorial, this high-level function intelligence where you can start debating for yourself, what's this about and what do I really care about, and boil it down to perhaps a practice where you do it not at the time when you're in the grocery store and the Skittles are about to jump out off the shelf into your cart.
Right.
So this is the time to do it like now when you're listening to a podcast like this, when it's sort of a quiet moment, and start maybe writing something down for you. What is the dialogue that's going on in my head? And what is the strategy that I could employ that might get me that extra second or two to say, no, I'm remembering my grandchildren and how much I want to be there for their, you know, for their communions or their 10th birthday or their wedding or whatever it is, and that I can't mess this up by allowing this old habit to run my life.
That's right. And it's the other important thing to remember is that it's not easy. It's not supposed to be easy, and it's okay, and that you shouldn't beat yourself up. And that's the other – that segues nicely into this next thing, and that's to sort of accept yourself unconditionally. It's called unconditional self-acceptance, or USA. When you make a mistake or when you don't make a mistake, the important part is that yourself – is not on judgment here. You're not beating yourself up. There I go again, eating like a pig. I'm so disgusting. The I am is not under attack. There is a healthy and rational and productive and skillful, as you would word it, way of reacting when you haven't made the ideal decision. So, and that is, okay, I overdid it, or I didn't make the ideal decision here, but I'm going to stop now, or I'm going to do it better next time, or for the next meal, I have a better way of approaching this. In other words, my decision wasn't ideal, but I am not bad as a person. There's
right.
a huge difference between those two things. And again, I'm not saying that this is easy. And again, it's really critically important that when you do mess this up, which you will do, you don't say, there I go again, messing this up. I can't even get this right. Again, you're not under attack. Your decision might not have been perfect for what your goal is or what your mission is, but you're not a bad person. The second you start saying you're a bad person, what you wind up doing there is leading yourself toward the Skittles and going for the comfort food or the couch potato lifestyle, or saying to yourself, well, I had one slice of pizza for lunch, so I just screwed up my whole diet, so I might as well have the Raisinets. I'm dating myself with an old dessert. I might as well just have another bag of Skittles, or I might as well now have a chocolate bar, or I might as well just forget it. And now that I screwed up the week's diet, screw it all, I might as well now go for broke. And then you wind up getting into a pattern. And then, of course, we've all done this with our whole culture. And then we support each other doing this as peers. And then we go to Walmart and see everyone doing it. Then we see each other doing it on TV. And then we're all doing it. And that's the reason why 1 in 3 of us, and in some cultures, 1 in 2 of us is going to get diabetes sometime in our life. So
yeah.
That's the answer to your question, I think. This is a
you can see how all those tentacles of this insidious, habitual nature where this culture of abundance has really affected us. And so it takes for each individual, though, this awareness, this is what's happening. And I accept it. I understand it. Then the plan has to be put into action. But you mentioned now many times, though, you also have to want to take care of the person that we're talking about here, which is you.
Right.
And so, the byline for this show, Are You Taking Care of Yourself, sort of predicated on the notion that you actually care about that person. Because otherwise, why would you take care of that person? So, we have our favorite object. Let's say you have your favorite car or something. And, you take care of it. You bring it to the car wash and you change its oil and if there's a little scratch on it, you try to remove it as fast as possible. That's what you do when you care for something a lot. Many people, though, I find are follow through with these self-destructive habits largely because unconsciously, subconsciously, they're upset with themselves. And they may not like themselves as much as they could. And often that's a reflection of other people's messages, not really what's deserving. But if enough teachers and enough parents and authority figures tell you don't deserve it, you're not good enough, you might actually start living a life as if you believe it, and that leads to the self-destructive behavior. If you think about it from the commercial enterprises that are behind all the scenes here, is that they're thriving on this imbalance in culture and the way we hurt each other, and as you described, I would say beautifully, except that it's sort of sad, is that we sort of follow each other down the aisles of Walmart, and, there's pounds and pounds of candies, and everyone's favorites happen to be there. So we're sheep, leading ourselves to slaughter.
Right. There's that pattern, and then a simultaneous and equal and opposite damaging pattern, which is that we deserve it all. We should have everything. So we have that other message happening.
Right.
That
but there's news in this. But this could sound heavy, and for a while it is. I think there needs to be sort of awareness of what the truth is. But the real good news is once you're aware of the truth and you can discriminate myth from fact and somebody else's voice from your own, and you could see how you are deserving, and as you said, I think so appropriately, this does not require perfection. This allows you once in a while to have the Skittles, because I don't think any of us really should live as in a state of total denial and self-deprivation. But if we can restore balance, if we can find a way to restore balance, we can get there. And to restore balance doesn't mean you become balanced tomorrow. It means you move in that direction. And so all anyone needs to do is take a little bit better care of yourself today than you did yesterday and tomorrow than you did today. And if you can just creep in that direction, you will get there. And it's really self-fulfilling, and it works really nicely, and it feels good. And it's an example of why a condition like diabetes could be somebody's biggest blessing in life, because it could wake them up to the truth and force them to get themselves in shape in this way, and the payoff is remarkable. But it still gets back to this question, why is it so difficult? And I think, you know, we need new teachers, new leaders who are delivering positive messages and giving people tools and the means and motivating them and exciting them to do it. And then we need a new group of people that are not walking down the aisle of Walmart but are doing Tai Chi in the park in the morning and helping each other out that way. In fact, that would be my recommendation.
Right. It's not easy. And I think one of the things we still have to get to this idea of purpose, but one of the things that that I think helps is try to work on this thing we talked about in the book called toxic self-talk. The messages that we give to ourselves are constant, and there is a kind of script going on in our heads. Sometimes it's very irrational, and sometimes it's very unpleasant. And if we could just listen into it a little bit and pay attention to it, if we were to be saying those same things to a friend we were trying to keep, it would be very difficult to keep that friend. I talk to a lot of students on a daily basis. My students are, it's kind of like Grand Central Station in my office, and a lot of them are saying things to themselves. I can't believe it. I say to them all the time, because I'm constantly trying to encourage them, imagine if you were to say that to a friend. How possible would it be to keep that friend? You are always talking so encouragingly to your friends. Why don't you try to talk that way to yourself? And they look down and they say, well, I don't deserve it. Mm-hmm. And so it is a weird paradox that we feel like we deserve everything and we want everything, but at the same time, like you're saying, we're also beaten down. We're shamed somehow. And we have this weird paradox. So it's really important to imagine that we are guy in this equation, a guy named Albert Ellis, says, we have to accept ourselves just sort of unequivocally. And this involves acknowledging that we're very complex and we're in a process that's just ongoing. It's ever-changing and ongoing, and it defies sort of self-rating. Other people shouldn't rate us, and we shouldn't rate ourselves. We can't at any point rate ourselves. So we defy that. And this is really important. So if we say something to ourselves that poisons that our own well, we defeat our own purpose. So where things go wrong, because we're going to go wrong, we're going to make mistakes, we're going to hurt people, we're going to sometimes hurt ourselves, we have to just back up a little bit. Even if we're not creeping forward, even if we take a creeping step back or a big step back, we have to wake up the next day and say, okay, so I took a little step back in terms of what my goal or what my mission was. Today I'm going to try to do a little bit better and then try to do a little bit better. That's, I think, the important step. So let's talk a little bit in the last bit we have left about purpose, because we have scientific proof and we've got lots of anecdotal evidence and you've got thousands of patients and I've met thousands of people on my journey that prove this. If we have a purpose in life, our health outcomes are going to get better. One of the doctors with whom I wrote the series of 30-Day Diabetes Miracle books, Franklin House, calls this good health for what? And he asks this question all the time in a great Texas or Oklahoma accent. Good health for what? If we don't know for what we're trying to get better, be that our grandkids or be that what my mission was, which was to go from literally not being able to walk to getting to the top of Mount Kilimanjaro on my own without oxygen in the winter, which I was able to accomplish in 2008, that was my own goal, and I think people should have their own Kilimanjaro, even if that's a tiny little mission. For them, it could be massive. Good health for what? What is your own mission? What is your purpose? Is that getting to your 50th wedding anniversary? Is that being able to hold your grandkids? Is that taking your wheelchair out to a soccer field to watch your favorite team? What is that mission? The scientific evidence is out there. that if you have that mission, is it, you know, singing in the chorus of your church, you know, for the first time, what is that mission? If you have that plan, your health outcomes are going to get better. The proof is out there. This is critical. The outcomes are going to get better. You're going to feel better. You're going to feel part of something. You're going to have a purpose. Those studies exist across the board, and I wonder if you've had experience with this as a doctor, Dr. Finkelstein.
Well, I mean, you know, it's absolutely true, and I would say that I've seen it when people get sick, I would say deathly sick, where, you know, people are starting to talk, meaning physicians are starting to talk to people about how much longer they have to live for. And I know this from scientific research as well that you alluded to, which is that when people have something to live for, they do better than the odds. And their quality of life, which is as important and maybe more important in some ways looking at it, on a day-to-day basis improves because their commitment to themselves rises to a point that it maybe never has existed before, and they're feeling better about themselves, even in the midst of a disease. The only thing that I would sort of add, because I think that's so important by itself, is you could get to your 50th wedding anniversary, and I've seen people do this, and drop dead the next day. So the goals can be short and long term, and I think purpose should have, and if your desire is to live even longer, is to have an inevitable or an immortal quality to them, which may have something to do with your legacy and may have something to do with how you live each day of your life and how you take every breath, that you're living in such a state of authenticity right now that there are no regrets. That, to me, is an important qualification because that allows you not only to get to your 50th wedding anniversary, but go beyond it, and that every step between now and then isn't just about achieving the goal, but is about being in the moments between now and then, because it's the moments where we're actually living, and that's when, if we're doing it well, we can look at our blood sugar on the monitor, and we can look at our blood pressure, and we can look at our weight, and we can look at how easy it is or difficult it is to eat wisely, and we can see the difference because we're mindful. And that, I think, is really the thing that I would sort of add to what all that you're saying, and can really appreciate how all this can make a difference. And again, you said it a number of times, this is not easy, but what's the alternative?
I love that. I want to end on a note about what's going on in my mind about this disease that I have and that I share with millions of people around the globe. The idea for my book that I did with Dr. Seal and Dr. House came from our sharing thoughts that are very much like yours about lifestyle medicine, and that's the extent to which we're taking care of ourselves as a culture. On one visit in the winter of 2005 to the Lifestyle Center of America, we were sitting around the boardroom talking about two very alarming articles that came out about diabetes. They came out in the same week in major newspapers, one in the Boston Globe and one in the New York Times. And I want to read you two little pieces from those articles. This one's from the Globe. It said, type 2 diabetes is sweeping so rapidly through America, we need not waste time giving children bicycles. Just roll them in a wheelchair. Forget the basketballs and baseballs. Give them Braille flashcards. The next thing you know, iPods, Game Boys, and Xboxes will come with glucose meters. This one's from the Times. Within a generation or so, doctors fear a huge wave of new cases could overwhelm the public health system and engulf growing numbers of the young, creating a city where hospitals are swamped by the disease's handiwork, schools scramble for resources so they accommodate diabetic children, and the workforce abounds with the blind. Now, this is going on 10 years, and these predictions are coming true. And I just want to remind people that this disease, type 2 diabetes, is preventable. And lifestyle medicine doctors like Dr. Finkelstein and lifestyle proponents like I believe that this disease is reversible. But so far, this disease is getting worse rather than better. Now, I have a very different picture in mind. I have a picture of a global miracle, and that's millions of us, millions of people listening right now, are overcoming this scourge people conquering the negative forces of our culture and living in renewed health, vigor, optimism, because they're taking care of themselves. This is Dr. Finkelstein's idea coming to fruition. And I want all of us to sort of be together in that picture, sort of beaming and proud and kind of helpful again. The only way that's going to happen is if we're not waiting for someone to do that for us. Again, this is a disease that happens in our mind because we're making the wrong decisions. So both of us are here now to urge you to start taking care of yourself. That happens if we mind the gap between the stimulus that's happening there in the culture and the response. Responsibility means being responsible. We have the ability to respond to what happens out there. So we urge you to do that now. Take care of yourself, please, and thank you for the time, Doctor.
Ian, so well stated, and again, a pleasure and an honor to spend the time with you. You are not only knowledgeable on the subject, but passionate about it, and it's not a surprise because you deal with it every day. And again, I think that's the humility that we all need, which is that we're dealing with the full catastrophe every day, all of us. There are all sorts of things that are going on, and so we have a choice. We could either give into it, we can follow the herd over the cliff, or we could take matters into our own hands, and we know what to do, and the benefits are clear, and I think they're almost certain. And I wish everyone who's listening well in doing that. There'll be more of these podcasts. Tune back in to areyoutakingcareofyourself.com whenever you have a few minutes, and there'll be something else inspiring to speak of. Until the next time, this is Michael Finkelstein, and I'll be with you in spirit. Take care.